Welcome to Give and Take, the interview podcast, where I, Scott Jones, talk with people that make my world and yours a more interesting place to live. This week, I had the pleasure of talking with Derek Webb, who is a 20-year veteran of the music industry. Derek has sold millions of albums as a founding member of a Texas-based folk rock band called Cademan's Call, and in his own words, has ruffled political and spiritual feathers alike as a solo artist. He's also the co-founder and president of the revolutionary tribe-building platform Noise Trade, and he's expected to come out with a new album in 2016. I had the occasion to speak with him at the Mockingbird Conference in New York City, and it was a great conversation recorded just after he played a show for the attendees. I give you my conversation with Derek Webb, which also features David Zoll, the founder and director of Mockingbird.
Record. Like top to bottom.
I think it's, but I think if you put Caribbean Wheel in there,
yeah.
I think I've heard you cover.
I have covered Every Grain of Sand.
That's a perfect song.
It is. It's a great song. Oh my gosh, that song. And the version that Emmylou Lou Harris did on Wrecking Ball. There's a few different lyrics that are better, that better than the version that he sang. That apparently were alternate lyrics that he gave her that she could sing.
Really?
and they're so much better.
I've got that. I know that
it's in the last,
but it's a God's sort of difference.
Oh yeah. It's amazing. The lyric is incredible. The different lyric is incredible. The one that Emmylou Harris sings.
Wow.
But I have wanted to, and I've said that I was going to way before Ryan Adams did 1989. For 10 years, I've been saying I want to cover the entire Shot of Love album.
Derek. Oh,
like I want to do the whole album.
I love your democracy stuff.
The democracy stuff.
I like that stuff. But I really think
I would love, the only thing I thought as I've thought about doing it that I was like, how would I do it is Lenny Bruce. Lenny Bruce is dead. Like I don't know how I'd do that one. And make that I don't know what could I bring to that song.
I'm do you sure. vote, dude?
Huh?
Do you vote?
Do I vote?
No.
Are we
recording right now?
I've been recording for like a minute.
Good.
Okay.
I was like scrambling because there was a lot of good stuff said and I was missing it. So I just like threw it on.
No, that's good. I do sometimes. My thing with voting is that if what I typically tell people, and this is certainly the way my ethic about voting is, if your conscience will allow you, then by all means vote. But if you're voting defensively to say, I like have like a moral issue with both candidates, but I want to vote for the lesser of the two evils to block the other, like as a defensive vote. What I invite people to do is like, you are at liberty to not vote. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like it's more perilous to risk violating your conscience than to not vote.
You would not recommend that in chess.
In chess.
A block is a good move in chess.
In chess it is.
Might be bad.
I've got a lot of friends who are like, for instance, who are who tend towards third party candidates, who tend towards independent candidates, and people think they're crazy, and they're like, well, you know, you're throwing your vote away, and I'm like, you know what, like when it comes to voting your conscience, like be a fool and vote your conscience. Like if there is an actual candidate who you feel like lines up with the way that you see the world, Even beyond just how good it would be for a third party candidate to have to break the two party system, which we would probably never do, but to have like a real showing for a third party candidate, like Ron Paul almost had, and he really, like that would be such a good thing. Like we're so locked in, a two party system just feeds on a polar extremes. You know what I mean? Mm. So like one person, like as soon as they hear somebody say something, they immediately say something that's the total opposite, and that becomes the platform. And it's like, it'd be good for us to have a third, an odd number of candidates. But so I typically tell people, like, if you want to vote third party and you're only the only thing keeping you from doing it is thinking that you're being stupid and you're throwing your vote away, like throw it away if you're doing it on your, if it means keeping in line with your conscience. Throw your boat away.
So the second last song you sung, I forget the title. Tell me the song. Title of the song.
Savior on Capitol Hill.
Do you think politicians are really more corrupt than the average? I think they're less corrupt because they don't have the luxury of a private life.
That's
like
right.
You can screw up a tweet, like a dick pic, if you're Anthony Weiner, and delete it. You can't do that. If your average person can do that.
Right.
I mean, not that I've ever done. No, but I mean, like, you know what I mean? But I think they become mirrors.
They're so scrutinized.
I think they almost, like, it's the sort of, like, Game of Thrones shame. Like, shame. Shamed. Yeah, like, yeah. So, in some sense, they are almost like mirrors of ourselves. It's like it's almost like a scapegoating thing. It's where we kind of put our secret shame on them.
Sure, they're the crosses upon which we hang our sin to be justified.
Yeah,
I mean, I don't disagree.
Jesus
with that.
For president.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that. The only thing is, I think that they're probably just better. I think they just have to bury it deeper.
That's what somebody asked Trump. They were like, "Is Ted Cruz the dirtiest politician you've ever seen?" Trump was, "Oh, no, not the dirtiest. The dirtier ones are smart. They don't get caught. He's the most dishonest, but he's not smart. The smart ones get away with
it." That's what I'm talking about. That's what I mean.
Lying to.
Yeah. And so, I mean, I think, here's my thing, is I'm suspicious of anybody, like, I mean, this is like, it's a cliche, but like Mr. Smith does not get to Washington anymore. Like, I just do not believe that. Mm. Like, in order to have a voice in a race for power, you have to, just specifically in American politics, you just don't get there unless you have resources that can only be provided by people who are going to come calling at some point. Like, they're all getting in all your pockets. And there's kind of no way around that. Like, I mean, unfortunately, I've always said, unless you're independently wealthy, you could fund your own campaign.
Yeah, gosh, Derek.
What? Unfortunately, the one character who has done that and is doing it smashingly right now is somebody who I think probably has no business running for office. But
Bernie Sanders has raised more money than any candidate. I mean, so maybe he is.
Well,
maybe he is the populist in the sense of, like, he's actually raising. Do you see a parallel to that, like in the music industry, like where people, okay, I'm gonna circumvent like the sort of the music industrial complex,
right?
And go directly to the
right. I think that the business as it is today, the head of the sales curve is an anomaly to get into. Like even the executives, there used to be a decade ago, 15, 20 years ago. There was a dollar amount. And if you spent that dollar amount, you could put an artist, any artist, into the head of the sales curve. You could. And you could sell millions of records. Mm. And it was just a series of things you had to do, and it was a dollar amount on it. Now,
I would kill if somebody would pay, because I could do like 4 karaoke songs. If there was a dollar amount,
I'm joking, though.
Dude, the only thing, I could be the best rock star. The only thing I'm missing, like, you see what I'm wearing. I feel like I have the panache, I have some eccentricity. The only thing I'm missing is talent.
But back in those days, that wasn't a problem.
That's exactly right. That didn't used to matter. And Milli Vanilli is a terrible example because they're the scapegoats and everybody does what they got caught doing. What I'm saying is, like, that used to be true. Talent was not required. But now, the way the music business works, man, it's all democratic and it's just the Wild West out there. So, like, you really...
Wild, Wild West.
A perfect example. And nowadays, like, all you can really do is you give it your best shot, and then if the impossible happens and you do wind up, the perfect storm of things happen for you, and something like Taylor Swift, or there's a handful of artists you could name. There's only a few now.
Adele.
These are the anomalies.
Monoculture.
Love the players.
But
I love the game. No, is that you hate the players? Like that song though.
No, well, the thing is, like, but when it happens, then you can throw all the money and all the things behind it, but you can't create the opportunity the way you used to be able to.
People are more cynical about it.
Yeah, I mean, Clive Davis used to be able to say, "Oh, here's Britney Spears. Watch me go make her number one. Like, watch me make her into a giant global pop star." And then he would do it. And now there just is not a dollar amount. Like, there is not that path anymore. It's like if certain things out of your control happen, you can throw millions of dollars after it and you can feed the fire, you can fan the flame, but you can't do it like you could. We are like in a post rock star culture now.
What is your path? Like as a musician, what's your path? Like when you think about like, okay, musically, like you said tonight that like I promise an album's coming out. So you're like, what motivates that? Like in the way the music industry is today, like what drives your kind of desire to do that? And like, what would success look like?
For me at this point, and I've been this way for a long time. I've said many times that like, if I sold 500,000 records next year, my career would be over. I'd be miserable. Like for me, the thing I've learned, and I've had the luxury of having been in a band for 10 years before my solo career started, that did pretty well. We didn't sell millions and millions of records, but we sold like in total, we sold a million records, but we weren't huge, but we were big enough for me to get a sense of what it takes to get there and to stay there and what you give up along the way to have that. And so because what happens is you get into the platform building business and you get into the platform repair business and you tell yourself you're going to get up there and you're going to say something important. You know, you're going to do that thing you got into it to do. You're going to get up there and you're going to say something and people are going to, it's going to be this crazy disruption. And you tell yourself that's what you're going to do. And that's the reason you have the platform, right? But then what happens is over time, if you succeed at it, then what happens is all of a sudden there winds up being a lot of like people's jobs and a lot of lives that are tied up in that platform staying, right? Like that continuing to work. And all of a sudden, all your time goes into securing and building. And then you tell yourself like, but if it got a little higher, think of what I could do. Like, I'm going to get up on that thing and I have so many friends who were successful. They had like some real ambition to really change things and disrupt things and say important things and whatever. And then they suddenly had a little success. The platform started to grow. And then they start to tell themselves that story of, you know, but I got to keep my platform secure because one day I'm going to get on, I'm going to say something. And they have these amazing.
You're saying at some point you wake up and you're like, I'm doing like Amway or Advocare.
Yes, that's right. And you have these amazing.
And I got the market, I got the fans, I got the thing. And someday you're like, I forgot why I'm doing it.
That's right.
I'm just managing the.
Your bio is the truest thing about you. Like all of a sudden you have this amazing platform that you will never ascend. And so when I started my solo career, that was what I committed to was I want to stay low to the ground. That is my plan. So that if I get knocked off, I can get back on fast. And if it gets destroyed, I can rebuild it fast. But I want to stay low to the ground. So I want to figure out what is that for me, that threshold that's just the right amount of success where I can make a living at it, but that I have to work at it, where it stays blue collar for me and I have to continue to work at it every single time around. So that no one, because here's the thing, like the greatest success in my career has been my total lack of success. Every great thing I've done is a result of never having had one big spike successful moment in my career where people start paying attention. Because I'm on a record label, I have been for 10 years on a record label with artists who sell millions or big artists, and they are combed over and picked at. And the label comes in and just micromanages all the recording process and the writing process. They leave me alone. Like nobody comes to the studio when I'm making a record. I turn those things in finished. I've never had any big success, so no one's putting pressure on me to recreate the big success I've never had. So I get to make records about whatever I want, put them out whenever I want.
I think that is success.
And that is the best thing I've got going for me. So it's like, I don't want one more fan. I don't want to sell one more record than I'm selling currently because I make a living at it and it keeps me honest and it keeps me off the radar.
You don't want to sell one more. What about 200 more?
Maybe 200 more. But the point is, there is a threshold and it's real that like all of a sudden people start paying attention. The record label starts paying attention and all of a sudden there's opportunity. And then, and it's so easy to give into it. And you think, man, wouldn't things be just a little easier if I could sell like a few thousand more records, make a little bit more money, be so much easier. But it's like, once you get to that point where you're making a living at it, you got to figure out where that threshold is and you got to start self-sabotaging.
Louis C.K., different field, but I mean, it says the same thing. Like basically he gets paid $350,000, or this is like 2 years ago, I think, but $350,000 an episode. But
yeah,
But that's like he hires his own writers. Like that's production. So he's not making a ton of profit.
Right.
But he's like, you know, I mail in and they don't really do any editing. Like I mail them a product and it airs. And so there's this sense in which for the creative freedom.
Right. And I heard that about him when he signed his deal with whoever it is, FX or whoever puts his show, whoever distributes Louis.
It's FX.
And he's taking a break from that right now because he just finished. He did the first season of Horace and Pete, which if you have not seen,
I feel
you like can only watch it. You can only online, download it from his website.
Yeah,
it's like $3 an episode. 9 episodes, first season just finished. It's one of the best, most genre bending shows I've ever seen. You won't believe how good it is. He paid for all of it out of his own pocket, and he gave up on Louis for at least a year. He's saying maybe he'll never do Louis again. But the point is, when he signed that deal with FX, I heard he could have gotten a way better deal for way more money, but he didn't do it because FX said, we're going to pay you less, but we'll give you more control. And he traded upfront money for control. I mean, he edits his show on his laptop. You know that?
Like, well, you know, I edit this podcast on this laptop. how fucking impressive is that? I'll edit the bleep. I'll bleep that up.
But it's true. Like, you know, but he, so he gave up and that and I'm not like Louis C.K., but like,
you're thinner, better looking.
Just a little bit thinner and shorter. But the thing is, like, I know after 20 years in this business, I know the compromises that I could make to somewhere records. I know exactly what they are. But I get better sleep selling fewer records and making records about what I want. So yeah, it's like, I wouldn't give that up for anything.
It's true. It's undeniably true what you're saying. But no one actually chooses that almost ever. That's why Louis C.K. is such an outlier. And Derek, in your own way, I think very much you've shown this to be. You'd much rather be able to have your artistic vision completely in your own hands.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there were points when they say, "Hey, if you actually make this worship record, or if you do this kind of fluffy stuff." And you said, actually, I'll take less money. And, you know, everyone, one of the things I'm struck with in life is that the message of so many Hollywood films and so many television shows is money doesn't make you happy. And that there are things that are more important than money. And everyone sort of nods their heads, but no one actually believes that.
And it costs a lot of money to make those shows.
It says that.
They're not art films.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Right. That sounds right. Self-righteous, but I think that that's what's so cool. Now, can I ask a music question?
No.
No.
Yeah, of course, dude. I'm not the teacher.
Well, I have two questions.
Mr. Soul in the back. You guys see your hand up?
I have two questions. Something I'm interested in, first of all, is Derek, you've put out a lot of different kinds of records.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really cool. That's what the artist most people feel strongly about, at least the people that I talk to who like read books about them.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the Bowies. It's the Dylans. It's the ones who've all these phases who've failed spectacularly at some time.
That's right.
And
that's
like
the risk you take. Yeah.
Yeah. When you look back at 20 years, is there anything you think didn't get the response you hoped for, or you feel is underrated, or you're especially proud of that you would, you know, like what would you? If someone said, hey, you know, I kind of wish people had picked up on that record a little more.
Such a good question.
I listened to it.
And I have an immediate answer.
What is it?
Well, I mean, well, first, let me say, so it doesn't sound like complaining. Like, I have had I think every single day about what a luxury my career has been. I am so lucky. I mean, having, like, gone right out of high school, barely got out of high school, didn't even think about going to college, and just backed into this band that I didn't think was going to go through the summer, that wound up being a 10-year career that basically set me up to walk into a solo career and take chances right out of the gate. You know, She Must Shall Go Free, my first record, is a very unlikely debut. If I had not just come out of 10 years in Cademan's and we hadn't had the success that we had, no one would have signed me. No one would have put that record out. Instead, I had a record label who not only signed me, but fought for that record, fought the retail on that record to you know, distribute it as it was. And they've supported me all the way through. And I've had like people who've supported me and come with me and put up with whatever crazy thing I've wanted to do. And I could not, and all of that career then also gave way to my backing into starting Noise Trade, which is the company that I founded like 8 years ago that I now run. So it's like everything about my life is an unbelievable luxury.
Okay, and we get it.
So let me say that because I
never pick up on it from you that you're taking this for granted. By the way,
yeah. Oh my God, I don't. I'm so
you're writing it as you go along. And
I
that's do. Cool.
I thought the first 5 minutes.
What a diva! What a prima donna!
This guy's like he's gonna ask me for like a Beyonce.
Exactly.
His rider is gonna be unbelievable.
Yeah, I came into the back of the church and shouted, "Where's my mimosa?"
Exactly. I asked for roses and only brown. Some people like I've heard like Stern talk about like from interviews. He's like. Some people put that stuff in the rider just to make sure it's red, like only brown M&Ms.
That's actually the origin of the brown M&M story.
Yeah.
It was from Van Halen. Van Halen did that.
Yeah.
Because stages were collapsing when they were playing in the 70s. I mean, literally, like people were like, and they realized that all these production people in these various cities were not reading their rider.
Yeah.
And so they put that one detail, they hid it in there.
I didn't know that.
And if they walked into a venue, and there were brown M&Ms in the bowls, they immediately got the production manager for the local crew to come out and recheck all the scaffolding.
Aha.
Because did David read your rider for the show?
I didn't even send one.
You didn't send a rider?
What he said was, I want a wood-paneled bathroom.
I want that. Robes that. And... okay, so anyway, to answer your question.
Yes, give me the goods.
The record of mine... So I've ever made two records the same. Hmm. And... which is its own conversation, but the record I did, not the newest, but the one before it, it was a very high concept record, very ambitious. It took me 2 years to write, record, conceptualize this record called Control. And it was a record that had another piece that went with it that was under a different band name called Soul of Me. And that record was the soundtrack to the film Nexus, which was not a real film. It was all stuff we made up.
Yeah.
And the two records interact in such a way where you can... we made them... at the same time, and you can actually drop. So I wrote the Control record. It was my commentary on the perilous fast adoption of technology into our lives. It was a record about my fear of how quickly we don't think of what we're giving up for what we're getting in terms of technology. And I'm such a geek and early adopter that's like it's really my story. But I wrote this little short three-act little short story about this guy who falls in love with technology, falls in love with his computer and wants to occupy the virtual world and kills himself trying to do it.
Hmm.
And then wrote the entire album from the perspective of that character. And it's his journey. But then the Soul of Me record is the story of this spiritual, it's a computer, but it's like basically the story of the singularity, the moment that the first computer wakes up and has a consciousness. Hmm. And it's her story. And I wrote it, produced it, but I had a different singer sing all the songs to give it a different voice. And the crazy thing is you can literally take this. We crafted it. We spent so much time on this. It's crazy. But if you take the Soul of Me record and drop it in between songs 7 and 8 of Control, it turns a three-act story, which is really a comedy, which is that the protagonist is better off at the end than he was at the beginning, into a tragedy. Because you realize that the guy does not survive. He dies and the computer wakes up in his place and wreaks havoc on the world. It becomes a four-act story, and it literally works seamlessly. The audio flows.
By the way, everybody, spoiler alert.
No, it's already over. It's already over. I mean, I tried to get people, so I didn't tell anybody. I released the two records months apart, didn't tell anybody any of that.
Yeah.
And the thing is, like, a concept record that dense, nobody has the time for that record. And so it was like, it hit the market like a rock. I mean, an electro-pop opera about the singularity, nobody has the time for that record. So it was all house and no door.
Well,
and I don't think I'll ever do better than the Control and the Soul of Me. I don't think I'll ever make a better project than that. And literally,
I feel so vindicated right
nobody
now.
Nobody even knows that record came out. No one's heard it. Nobody. And the thing is,
Control or Soul of Me?
Both, but Control was the record I put out under my name.
Yeah.
The two records had everything to do with each other.
Yeah.
And eventually I just wrote a blog and said, okay, well, everybody, here's what we just did like 18 months ago. Nobody cared. So I'm going to tell you now.
It didn't
so
seem like there was like much it. Promotion for that record, to be honest with
we
you.
We did what we could, but like, again.
David, did you tweet about it?
Actually, I just made this mix. Hey, come on. You know who you're talking to.
You got a digital footprint.
You know who you're talking to. I just wrote this annotated playlist of Derek's music, and I was listening to, you know, I spent some time with it, and the more I listened to the Control record, which I listened to actually quite a bit because it is not the most accessible of what he's done, and he's got this incredible Sacred Harp stuff that is going on in it.
It's like sampled shape note music from the turn of the century and but like I wrote guitar and drum beats.
I said this is the artistic high point of his music.
Here's Derek at his most self-indulgent.
Well, it's honestly, like it's the coolest music you've done.
I've still never heard anything like it. I mean, it's like a sound I'd never heard before.
Exactly.
I heard it in my head, and I wanted to make that record, and I made it. Sometimes you've never heard it before because it's not a good idea. That might be the case with that record. But the point is, like, I'll never be prouder of a record. I don't think I'll ever do better than that record.
Right.
But
well, I'm a sucker for concept records.
It's literally my least well-known record. It's like no one bought that record. Nobody. I had to cancel the tour like a month in. I had to cancel the tour because no one was coming out to the shows because no one bought the record. Nobody cared.
Yeah. Well, when someone does the next record is sort of like a quote unquote return to something. And those were great songs. The new songs were awesome. I loved the version of Closer to
Oh yeah, I was wrong. I'm sorry, I love you.
Yeah, I'm wrong. So, sorry, I love you. I like those songs. However, it was what those of us who are listening closely would call an artistic retreat. And
it was.
And that doesn't mean that it's still very the bar is high. However, you were out on a limb on Control.
Well, I started writing that record while I was on the tour for Control, basically imagining to myself, there's no way I'm going to get a year's worth of touring out of this record, which is what you hope. So I gotta abandon this.
So it was like a Sinatra move. Let's write some tunes that the young people enjoy.
Exactly. It was. I had to abandon my baby a little bit. I mean,
well,
I had
here's
to.
A question then.
Because I gotta make a living.
Okay, so first of all, what was that, Bane in My Baby?
Abandon.
I thought, because you said A House with No Doors. I'm a sucker for a good colloquialism. I've never heard that. I love that. And then I thought,
All House and No Door.
All House and No Door.
Versus All Door and No House. You know, everybody come in, right, we got nothing in here. Right,
yeah. Then you're like, I was like, Bane and the Baby. What is that? Jeez, that's like the Control record. That's the Control record colloquialism. Bane and the Baby. Okay, Bane and the Baby.
Well, that's yours now. You made that one up.
Yeah, well, I don't know what it means. It's the problem. I'm going to be coming up with
populated with meaning.
Can I ask my other question?
Yeah, of course.
Please.
Silence.
So, can you give us a little bit of a spoiler about, you talked about making a record this year.
Yes.
I get the sense you've got some things to say.
Yes.
I get the sense that another statement is percolating.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us?
I'm so grateful that anyone is interested at this point, because it's been a couple of years since I put a record out.
You promised us this year.
I did.
Promise keeper.
Yeah, and what I told everybody tonight, you witnessed it, is if you want details on the new album and tour that will come out in 2016, go to promisebreakers.com and all the details will be there.
I like that.
A URL that I own, and there's nothing at it, because that's the whole point of the URL.
See, it's meta, guys.
But anyway, it is. It's way up there. But, well, man, like, so here's the thing. The job of an artist, and the way I've always talked about the artist job description is to look at the world and tell us what you see. Mm-hmm. Look at the world and describe it. That's an artist's job. Because it implies all the right things. Like, you have a particular grid through which you're looking at the world. You have a particular perspective on that. That's what I want to hear. And it's taken me a couple of years to figure out how to describe the world as I see it at this point in my life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after like a couple of really hard years, it's hard to figure out how to. I haven't been blocked. I just don't know how to describe the world as I look at it.
Why not?
Because I mean, the older you get and the things you go through, it becomes harder and harder to you don't want to be Joni Mitchell. You want to save some things back for yourself. You want to protect things that need protecting. So it gets tricky. Because I've always been like a lay it all out there kind of guy. And I'm not a poet. I'm very didactic in the way that I write. But the way that great writers do it, like Dylan, he was revealing everything, but nobody knew it because it was so dense. The poetry of it was so dense and like so layered. It was like Inception. Like, you couldn't possibly figure out what he was talking about, but he was telling you everything. It's all there. You just don't have the key ring to figure out how to decode the whole thing. And so that's never really been my strong suit. It was taking me longer to figure out how to talk about the things that are important to me right now, the world as I see it, and do it in a way that's both healthy and protective.
Healthy and protected.
So it's like, you know, it's like you're you know, so the stakes get high and it just takes a while. But I'll tell you, like, I'm terrified of the songs that I'm writing right now. Like, the way that I always do it is I always encourage my friends, like, in the creative moments where it's literally like those first moments where it's just pen to paper, don't try to not be preoccupied with, what are people going to think? What's the label going to think? What's the radio going to think? What are my fans going to think? What's everybody? Just get it down first. Like, let that be a problem you have to deal with later.
Mm.
But get the songs written first. Don't pre-filter them. Like, don't...
Shitty first draft kind of Anne Lamott stuff?
No, I mean, a little bit. Like, because I just have friends who, like, have told me about, like, they'll play me some song that's on their record. They're like, well, man, this song started as this kind of song, and here's what I was going to say. And this was a line from it. And I was like, I wish I could hear that song. That sounds amazing. So, yeah, but I knew that, like, there's no way the label would have released the record with that song on it. And I knew there's no way I could get away with that. So I didn't write, you know, I had to change it all up. And I'm like, but why? Like, if not in art, where can we take chances like that? You know, where is that valued? And so that's, for me, I've always put, I push the pressure into the future of like, I'm going to push through the moment, push through my fear of what's somebody going to think, what's the fallout going to be? What's the risk? What is the risk that I'm taking by writing this lyric? I push that into the future to get the lyric written. And then I'm like, what have I done? You know what I'm saying? Like, and then I have to deal with it. Cause then once I've written the song, I'm like, well, I'm going to sing it. I'm going to record it. And I'm in trouble now. And I've gotten in trouble many times in my career as a result. But I'm which is to say, I'm terrified of the songs I'm writing.
Oh, wow.
Because I'm going to record them and I'm going to sing them and I'm fearful.
What's this style going to be? What's the palette?
Here's all I can tell you. Yes. I mean, it's something I've never done. And this is what I was going to tell you is like my only rule. And if you go back through all my records, this proves out, especially even with I Was Wrong with the new record. Say what you will about it. And I will never make a record like that again.
I love that record.
I don't regret it. But I would not make that record today, and I will never make a record like that again. I don't regret it. Here's why. Because the only criteria I have when I'm making records is that the record I'm making currently must be ironic compared to the record I made previously.
That's big L law or little L law?
Flexible. I mean, I'm flexible, but like that's, and if you, I mean, you know, like after Stockholm Syndrome, which was a record that got me in a ton of trouble. It was very polarizing. All my conservative base left me, you know, and the year after that record came out, Jen Knapp, who's a super good friend of mine,
right,
moved back to the country and started making music again. And while we were on the road together playing shows, she went on Larry King and very publicly came out. And it was like,
on Larry King. I forgot.
Oh, yes, she did. And it was like such a crazy moment to get caught up into. And I was like, I was looking at my friend and collaborator at the time, and saying like, what do we do after a year like this? Like, what do we do after Stockholm Syndrome? And then the whole year we had after and the fallout, what do we do? And he looked at me and he said, worship record. I was like, you're totally right. That's what we got to do. We got to make a worship record, which is what I did. But I did it my way.
The Lord's Prayer record.
I made an instrumental electronic record based on the Lord's Prayer. A classically composed electronic record. Again, all house, no door. And
label loved it.
But again, it had to be ironic. That was like, no one will be expecting that after that record.
Yeah.
And so it will meet that criteria.
Okay.
I can definitely tell you that. And the other thing I can tell you, and I don't know though till I get there, because that's my other thing I stopped doing is making plans based on the product I wanted, what I wanted to have as a result of the process. I don't think like that anymore because I've already learned that the record you make when you aim to make when you get like, I know the record I want to make and there it is and I'm just trying to get there. There's all this space between where you are and what it took to make that record. The record you make is never the record you set out to make. It's a testament to all the compromises you made trying to make the record you wanted to make. Mm. So I just stopped thinking like that. And now, when I think about making a record, the only thing I think about is who do I want to work with? Who do I want to spend time with? Mm. Like, what friend do I want to collaborate with? What do I want to learn? Is there like some instrument or some style of production that I want to learn about? Like, what? Because the thing is, like, I don't spend any time with the records once they're made. I make them, I put them out, and it's over.
Right.
And I move on immediately. I mean, I have to revisit and figure out how to cover those songs as a folk singer. Because when I play live, I bring an acoustic guitar. I don't bring a drum machine. I don't bring any of that stuff. So the majority of the time I spend around a record is the 6 months I spend making it. I mean, that's my life. I'm spending my life doing this.
Right.
So it's now my question is, what is my process? Do I want my process to be? Who do I want to spend it with? What do I want to learn? And I don't even think twice about what we're going to make or if anybody's going to be interested in it. I could care less. Like when I went in to make the Control record, when I went to make the Stockholm Syndrome record, when I went in to make a lot of these records, I thought, you know who I really want to spend some time with? Is my buddy Kaysen, my buddy Josh, or my buddy whoever. And like, I want to spend some time with them. And they're great. They're multi-instrumentalists. They're great. Let's spend some time. Let's see what we make together. And I'd really love to learn how to play. I'd love to like play the nylon string guitar. It's been years since I played classical guitar. That'd be really fun. That's the Control record. I want to learn about shape note singing. I want to study that music for a year and see what comes of that. Those are the only choices I make. What we make of it as a result does not matter to me in the least. And so What I can tell you is there's a guy named Ryan Alexander. He's the lead singer and songwriter in a band called Civilian, and they are like one of my favorite bands. He is writing the most important songs I'm hearing anywhere right now are coming out of this guy, Ryan Alexander. The new Civilian record, which is coming out next month, I think. I think it's called I Can't Believe How Much Privilege Costs, I think is the name of the record. It's something like that. And it's got some amazing long title.
Oh, and, if you're white, it's free.
And
white privilege, right? That's
and,
just comes
exactly. Birth, right? And that's right.
It's free.
And when you hear this record, it is full of all the songs. He's writing all the songs I want to be writing right now.
Okay.
And he and I have gotten to be really good friends in the last couple of years. And he is my collaborator. Like, Ryan and I are going to make a record this year. We might make an EP on the side and call it some band name just to do it before we make the record. We make it in a weekend or something. But we are going to work together. He's going to help me write the songs. And he is like really big into big, crazy electric guitars. And so maybe it'll, I'm kind of thinking maybe it'll be a big, heavy electric guitar, but like in, I'm kind of feeling like Reznor kind of industrial programming underneath it. So I'm thinking like hyper melodic, industrial kind of distorted programming drums with like crazy big electric guitars. Maybe.
Can we talk about the elephant in the room right now?
So now we're done. Yes.
So David's wife is pregnant again. So you look at his jeans. Could he transition to mom jeans in the next 3 years? I'm not, they're not terrible. But I mean, in all seriousness, I mean, so you had a rough.
Scott's wearing a scoop neck as we speak.
I bought this.
Just want to say that.
For David's disco neck. When I saw that cat t-shirt.
Causing me to stumble.
I went to Forever 21 and bought this. I didn't know they even had men's clothes.
Uh-huh.
It's funny because
do they?
I'm not sure.
They do now. It's funny because
men can put the clothes on that they sell there.
No,
I think you've done.
It's an M. This is in the men's section.
Okay.
Yeah, my wife and I might open a store called Forever 39. It's all just like couches, yoga pants, and wine. That's Forever 29, rather. Yeah, Forever 29. Great. But sure. It's 39-year-olds, but Forever 29.
Yeah.
So like, you've had like a rough year personally.
Yeah.
But the music you did was not Victorious Christian Life, right? I had this friend, right, who was in campus ministry, and you know, he would, his middle name was A, so like, you know, I don't know, let's just say his name was Ford A. McKinley. I'm getting this because I listened to this podcast, this Jewish podcast, Unorthodox, and they said that like Merrick Garland, the Supreme Court appointee. Like, how does a Jewish guy get a name like Merrick Garland? And they were all trying to think of their Gentile name. So one guy's like, well, what I would do is come up with like something first. Your first name is something a Jew generally wouldn't buy. Economy car, like shoddy economy car. And then a really outdoorsy place you're not going to find many Jews. So I would be Ford McKinley. I'll make up my Ford A. McKinley.
Okay, Ford A. McKinley.
So
yep.
Just a
friend of yours.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Ford A. McKinley.
Campus ministry.
But he would say, my name is Ford A. McKinley. Which, and the A stands for adulterer. And everybody would go, and then he'd go, because I've been unfaithful to my God. And everybody would go, we thought you were talking about sex. Like, yeah, so, right. So on some level, like, you write music that talks about your own dependence. Like, you don't write music that's sort of like rah-rah, I'm a superstar. I'm believing more. I'm getting parking spaces onward and upward. You know, I'm praying for parking. But then, do people treat you differently now because you're in a posture where you actually have to ask for grace, or it's implied that you need to? Whereas before, it was like, we like when you're saying every grace, we just don't like you to need it.
That's really well said. Yeah. You know what? I don't really know. And maybe I'm going to find out pretty soon because, like, I haven't put a record out in a couple of years. And I've been kind of, you know, living underground running Noise Trade, which is the company I founded about 8 years ago. And it just coincided with, you know, there were a handful of things all happening at once. And one of those things was I was like, after the I Was Wrong record, I was like, you know, I'm like at the 10-year mark, the 11-year mark in my career, as a solo artist. And like, Noise Trade, I felt was a better fit for me professionally at that point because I have so much more ambition for the careers of my friends and for the health of the independent music market than I do for my music career at that moment. So, and it was, there was just a, an opportunity. Our board was, had asked me before what it would take for me to step in and play a leadership role in the company. And I was like, I've got my day job that I love. And I can't imagine ever having the time to, you know, learn how to, let alone run a company. But it was just that perfect moment where I was like, you know, I could probably take a break. I could probably use a year or two off. And not have to go out and endure the exposure of being out in front of all these people and not knowing, you know, where my footing is. And so I've taken a couple of years off, and it's been amazing. Great things happening for our little company. But I don't really know, but what I can tell you is it is interesting that, you know, I've been singing songs for more than 10 years that confess things worse than I've done in my life that, as it turns out, are not false advertising. And so I don't really know why that's a shock to anybody.
So, full disclosure, I've gone through some rough passages, and those songs were, thank you, they were incredibly comforting.
Well, that's reciprocating vulnerability for vulnerability is a generous thing, and I appreciate it. And so it's like, for me, I think people are kind of bummed out when it turns out that it wasn't false advertising. Like, that wasn't a metaphor. I was being serious. I really meant all that. And I think you're right. People are okay with you saying it, but not okay with you actually really needing it.
Yeah. Do you still go to church?
No.
Is that conscious? Like, it's sort of like, hey, this is a sabbatical from...
Yeah. I mean, I think that you go through seasons where it can be healthy to deconstruct and reconstruct things. And I think I'm just on the precipice of the reconstruction period right now. But for me, it's been a very good and very healthy thing to, especially like the irony is that, if church, the idea of church, if it's being done right, it should feel more like an AA meeting than an Amway convention, right?
Yeah.
Like, but that's not how most churches feel. Like, even the guy in the front's like, my name is so-and-so and I'm a total wreck and come with me and let's all go get healed together, whatever. That's not how it feels. That's not typically what you find. And for me, I have through the last year or two that I've had, the people who have really come up around me and the people who have really showed up and really, I mean, I've had an almost 100% friend turnover in the last 18 months. And the people who I have now are people who I found in bars and people who I found in, like, people who, it's just funny how the friends you make when the first thing that people learn about you is the worst things are the best friends you can find. Mm. And that's not typically how friends are made. That's not typically how church community works. That's not typically how really any friendships work. I'm not trying to blame the church for that. I'm saying, most friendships, you meet somebody, you have something in common, you know, something, you have friends in common or you have a common interest, but it's good things. It's based on good things. The people who you meet and the first things you learn about each other, like in people you meet in like certain kinds of groups and certain kinds of, are like when the first thing, and maybe the only thing for a long time that somebody knows about you is the worst thing about you, it's a pretty amazing thing to then get to know those people. And then you're kind of delighted and surprised when you find out good things about them.
there's this thing.
Because you know those people will never leave you. And I thought that about other people. And that didn't turn out to be true. And I'm not saying I made that easy. But I'm just saying, like, I'm very grateful for the people who I have, who, you know, my community of friends now, those people are just not congregated in churches. They're mostly congregated elsewhere.
There's a thing called Creative Mornings. Like, it's I don't know if you ever, like, it's a... It started in New York, where they would have once a month like a kind of TED Talk kind of thing for creatives. So your name tags, though, it'd be like Scott, you know, and then you'd have to also answer a question, like, what would you do if you weren't afraid? So it'd be like, Scott, I'd start that coffee shop, or,
right,
you know, Joanne, I would talk to my estranged relatives. So it's funny because this is full disclosure because you've been incredibly vulnerable.
Yeah.
So this is so insane, and this is testimony to... I saw my name tag and it said attendee. And I was like, wait, I think I'm like a speaker. I think I'm a staff person. And I thought, like, gosh, I guess I'm not that significant. Like, so, but then I thought, my wife has the attendee thing and she's delightfully significant. So I was like, okay. So I thought, like, what would I want my name to be? So I was like, neurotic was the first thing I put on my name tag because I'm the rat. Because only a neurotic person would think this about your name tag. So then I thought, like, it's just the Lutheran thing, pride of Jedi. Well, because I think I'm insightful about things. So I'm a neurotic Jedi. So then somebody said to me, neurotic Jedi, I'd love to know what that would be in the Star Wars universe. I said, well, I think every Jedi is neurotic. The balance of the Force. You know, I mean, this could
be preoccupied
people.
With it.
Yeah, if they had Purell, it would have been, you know, all the Jedi's before they touched their lightsabers. Who touched Yoda's lightsaber? Purell, I need. But yeah, I think like, that would. But how great would it be if we actually, if we had to, like, disclose things like that on some level that. So religiously, okay, it's really interesting. People like today, sociologically, talk about the nuns, right? The people that are non-affiliated. But then there's another. Oh, shoot. Okay. Can I just ask one question, then we'll bag it?
Someone's waiting for me.
Oh, just one more.
Yeah.
None are done. You just need to walk out. I can just. This is my last question.
Here, hold on.
So then there's been some sociological work on the duns. And these are people that still would ascribe to faith. And like God or Christ or things like that. But they're just like, I'm done with the church. I'm not, I could still say the Nicene Creed. You know,
right.
So like, are you kind of, you don't strike me as a nun. Like, you're not like, I'm not, but are you for a season in the dun?
See, the thing about it for me is that it's all part of that deconstructive and reconstructive kind of process for me is like, I'm such a, I'm the opposite of the typical artist personality. I'm the opposite. Most artists are like abstract and poetic. And
have you ever taken the Enneagram?
Sure, I'm a one with a nine.
Oh, wow.
I'm a full one.
Wow, that's great. Dude, that's a great
one. So I am, like most of my artist friends are, again, like abstract, poetic. You know, they can tell you how they feel, but not any detail. I am hyper detail, rational, analytical. Hyper analytical.
David's a two, so he'll meet your need if you need.
Well, I'm a one. And so, or so I'm told. I don't know. I took the test. My friends hyper analyze it. But, and so for me, it's like the last time I put any real thought into the construction of my kind of theological grid, I don't know that I would allow myself Jesus without the church. I don't think I would allow myself that because I don't really see a version of Christianity that does allow for that. Because he himself said, like, we're diverse members of one body, not any one person. Like, I've never believed that you could just go up on the mountaintop and have the sunset and there's you just do church up there all by yourself. I don't think that's like, I've never been able to say, I'm going to just cherry pick and make my own thing out of this. As I look at the whole counsel of the Bible over time, it's like you're kind of all in or you're not in. And so for me, like, I don't know that I could really do that. I don't know that I, at least in the last time that I thought real hard about that, there was not a version of it that would allow me Jesus without the church. And so is there a season where maybe I'm having to say no to both for a minute? Maybe. And I think if I come back to it, I'm gonna have both. I don't think there's a version. I just don't. So it's like, I have a very high view of scripture. I have a very high view of I have a very conservative theological ethic when I have it. And
that is so.
It's a great answer.
Articulate, authentic, and self-aware.
That's just the only answer I have right now.
Hey man, thanks for, this is, I feel like it's like a, such an abrupt ending to our conversation, but the night goes on and we're in
that's
New York.
True. We are in New York.
Hey, we have
other things to do,
yeah,
right?
We gotta do things. We gotta have a little
fun. We got disco
to get to. But thank you so much just for playing and for your time and just for
pleasure.
Like, I feel like I know you better than I do.
It's a pleasure. No. Well,
the
I feel the same.
Pleasure is all mine.
I feel the same.
Thanks for listening to Give and Take. As always, I'm Scott Jones, and if you like what you heard, please head over to iTunes and give us a rating and a review. And I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Derek Webb and David Zoll half as much as I did. So until next time, fare thee well.